packet pushers.
Welcome to Day 2 DevOps, where the DevOps is in the details. I'm Kyler Middleton, and on Day 2 DevOps, we explore those details and how you can learn from the mistakes of others and build a solid DevOps practice on Day 1 and beyond. With me on this journey of learning and doing is my co-host, Ned Bellavance. Hi, Ned.
Hey, Kyler. We have a banger of an episode, if I'm being honest right now. We are talking to Lydia Grassley. She is a threat detection engineer, and she talked to us about how modern cloud platforms are ridiculous, and it's okay to treat them that way. How tier one help desk experience is invaluable to learn the what and the why of software designs, and how AI, fortunately, isn't a good stand-up comic yet, and also isn't really a good threat detection engineer either. As I said, Lydia is a threat detection engineer. She works at Edward Jones, and she specializes in cloud security. She's been in the tech industry for 8 years with 5 years of experience as a detection engineer. She is passionate about sharing her knowledge and helping others navigate the complexities of cloud threat detection.
I saw Lydia speak earlier this year at SANS CloudSec Next in Denver, and not only did I find her talk entirely hilarious, I accidentally learned a whole lot about threat detection. So with no further ado, let's do it. Lydia, thank you so much for joining us on Day 2 DevOps. This is so exciting. I saw you speaking at CloudSec Next in Denver, and you were very educational, but also really funny. And so you mentioned during your talk that I sat through there that you have a history with stand-up comedy. And so I'm imagining your life is basically like the plot of Mrs. Maisel, and you're out until like 2 a.m. every night in a sea of drama. Is that what life is like?
Oh, because I'm old now. I'm a baby comedian, so I've done one show to my name, and I've taken some classes, but I have an interest in stand-up comedy, but if I'm a stand-up comedian, mostly it's by accident, but it's something that I really do enjoy, and I admire people that are on the road all the time making a good go of it. I just like to throw it into my teaching and my presentations because I think it helps people pay attention. And that's like half of the battle when it comes to getting people to learn stuff. So if you can make it funny, you can make them pay attention, and then the rest is easy.
If you can be more interesting than the cats on my phone, I will pay attention to you.
Yeah, that's tough because cats are great. I've got two. They're not in the room right now. I'd show you one, but you know, obligatory cat tax. But maybe they'll show up later because they do like to Zoom bomb all my meetings.
I love it.
They listen for when you pause and meow at that exact moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mine like to create calendar invites for me. So I'll just come back and be like, I have a 2:30 meeting for All right. Thanks, Ida.
Well, let's talk about what your talk was about. So you're now a cloud threat detection engineer, which to me seems like the opposite of stand-up comedy, right? So like that's very technical and dry. And where do you find that those skills overlap? How do you tie humor into engineering and teaching?
Well, I like absurd comedy. And the nice thing about the cloud is that there is no shortage of absurdity in the cloud, right? You guys know this stuff is not intuitive. It doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, people who want to move into cybersecurity, especially, they're like thinking that there's this grand overarching structure, right? There's this grand design and we just have to figure out the math and the structure behind it. You get into the weeds and figure out, no, you know, in the case of Microsoft, like this is 30 years of tech debt, you know, yeeted into the cloud.
Yep.
So, you know, not to knock Microsoft too much, because I do like to brag on Microsoft a little bit, but it's hard. It's hard. It's not intuitive. It doesn't make a lot of sense. There's not a lot of places you can go to just like get a big picture overview. It's just hard. And so if you can, you know, approach it from that level of the absurd of like when I pointed out, it's like, okay, here are four different ways that you can exfiltrate email out of an environment, right? Business email compromise, like, you know, huge revenue loss producer. I don't know if that's the right word for industry, like, you know, very high in the FBI's watch list as far as like bad things to look at for cybercrime. But like, you know, there's four different ways to do it and they're all over the product. And it's like, wouldn't you think like if you were a security person, like you'd want to put all these controls in one place, right? But they're not. They're scattered all over. And how do you learn that? You learn it by screwing up. You learn it by saying right. Like, I've got it now. I found this one. We're good, right? No, we're not. How about this one? Still not good. This one, still not good. This one, okay, that's better. there's probably like three other ways that you haven't really nailed down yet, and the bad guys are using that you can't detect on. And so, you know, approaching it from the absurdity and complexity and just like making that the focus and sort of like breaking down that sort of like mental barrier and just coming at it with the mindset that this is hard. It doesn't make a lot of sense. We have to laugh at it, because if we laugh at it, it'll be easier to tackle.
I forget what the current total is, but it's something like there's 40 some odd admin consoles for Office 365 / Windows 365.
Yeah, the last time I checked, there were 15 different admin portals in M365, just M365. That's not counting Azure. That's only the SaaS part of the house, right?
Right.
15 just for the SaaS part of the house. But they're doing this big old UI redesign in December, I think next month. So all the slides, like the screenshots that I took for my presentation, like gone. Next month, gone.
I feel that deeply, because I create training courses for Pluralsight and I cover Microsoft topics sometimes, and nothing about the product will really have changed, but all of my recordings are now wrong because they updated the UI.
Right.
That's fun. Or like the time that they changed it from Windows virtual desktops to Azure virtual desktops, which meant that every single slide was now wrong.
Yeah.
Because it had the wrong name.
And then there's the Defender nonsense. It's like, you think there would just be one Defender, right? No.
No.
I'm out of the loop here, so I'm going to be a proxy here. Is there not just one Defender?
Oh my goodness, no, Kyler. There is Defender for cloud apps. There is Defender for endpoint. There's like at least four, I think, the last time I checked, and that was a couple years ago. So like that answer is probably totally wrong. But yeah, there's a lot of different Defender stuff and they all cover different things and they're all charged differently. So, you know, maybe we'll get like Defender for hot dogs if the FDA goes away. So who knows?
Maybe. I mean, it was Azure Security Center was one of them. And then they changed it to like Windows Defender for cloud. And I was like, but it was so perfect. It was a security roll-up for your Azure subscriptions.
Yeah.
And now I don't know what it does.
Yeah. So, and Windows Defender for cloud is completely different than Microsoft Defender for cloud apps, right? Because they sound like they should be the same, because the cloud is there and the Defender is there. But no, completely different products, completely different pricing, completely different coverage.
Mm-hmm.
The absurdity is slapping me in the face right now. I avoid Microsoft stuff just in general. Like I'm just a Linuxy person, and this is making me so sad.
Yeah, I like it because it's ridiculous and I can make fun of it later. And also, I mean, I do like a challenge. I mean, I am a little bit masochistic in that regard, and that I do love the challenge and the constant change. But yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. And if you go in there feeling like you have to know it all, like you're going to get everything right in the first try, like you're going to fail. So like, let's just abolish that notion, because you're going to screw up a lot. You're going to mess up a lot. And that's okay. Everybody's messing up. Let's just accept it.
You were saying how Microsoft took 30 years of tech debt and just yeeted it into the cloud, which, yes, when you're thinking about being a threat detection engineer, is being a threat detection engineer for the cloud significantly different than on-prem if all these on-prem products just got thrown up into the cloud anyway?
It is extremely different.
Oh, okay.
Because traditionally in threat detection, right, your stuff wouldn't change that much. So people could write down what the threats were and how they worked, and that you could expect that that documentation would have a shelf life longer than 6 months, right? Which means that going through all the effort of figuring out how this stuff works and taking screenshots and taking code samples, like you could be assured it would stay there. Other people could learn from it. It would be usable for a period of time. And now the platforms change so fast, not just the UI, but the events themselves change, like new products are designed, APIs are retired, so much change that unless you've been working in the product and like kind of know the basics and have worked on it for like from an administrative side, it's really hard to do knowledge transfer on these threats without like doing some sort of screen sharing walkthrough, because stuff's not going to be the same. The logs are going to change. The UI is going to change. The APIs have changed. The PowerShell commandlets that I use coming up have been retired, you know, and new ones have taken their place. Like there's been changes to the Graph API and, you know, webhooks and all that stuff. Like that's all changed. And so you learn to become very zen about the cloud, right? It used to be people are like, we got to document this. We got to document. We got to do screenshots. We got to explain how it works. And I'm like, don't bother, guys. Don't bother, because you're going to spend so much effort documenting what it is right now. with the expectation like we've had in the past, where it's like we're going to have all this stuff and it's going to be solid forever, right? No, it's not. It's going to change. It's going to be completely different like 2 years from now. And all this work that you've put into documenting how it is at this moment is going to be useless. So like, why do that? Why do that to yourself? Like, why burn all of these people hours for no reason, right? There's got to be a better way. So I'm working on figuring out what the better way is. But again, being a cloud detection engineer, like part of my job is messing up a lot. I'm in the messing up a lot phase, as most of us are. And so it's like, there's a real paradigm shift. And SANS is going through this too, right? SANS, you know, their mascot for their cloud program is a fighter pilot. I feel like that's super appropriate, right? Because I feel like I'm out there dogfighting every single day. You know, the bad guys are moving and we're moving and everybody's moving all over the place. It's not like the more static, methodical approach that it was, you know, even 10 years ago.
My background is network engineering. And when you want to get good at it and move up in like your Cisco certifications, you almost always get recommended this book, TCP/IP, that was written in literally 1990, because like they wrote the standard, everybody implemented the standard. That's how it works. And you're done. That just doesn't exist now in cloud. They're actively building that plane as you're flying that plane. There we go. We could tie that into the SANS fighter pilot.
Yes, very good. They are very much building the plane. And like, they're also building the radar to track the plane too, right? Like, you know, syslog. Who knows syslog? Like the RFC for syslog to sort of like codify this, you know, inscribe it in stone for every, like that took 30 years. 30 years to RFC syslog, right? And that's for endpoints, which are supposed to be nice and stable. And none of this is going to be the same. So it's like learning how to deal with like not only learning what the threats are, but trying to create systems that are flexible enough that you can sort of like balance that need to like document what the threats are, document how they work, with the knowledge that if you spend too much time on this, you're just throwing time away because it's all going to change in 2 years anyway. So.
Wow. It's such a fast moving industry and things are rapidly evolving. What does your day-to-day look like? Are you just constantly reading through reports and like CVEs to see what the latest dumpster fire is out on the cloud?
Yes, we do a lot of that. But with Microsoft especially, like it's a super modular product, right? You can configure like Azure Active Directory or Entra, which I guess it is now. Ugh. Again.
Yep.
Like you can pipe that thing a million different ways, right? And so just because you discover somebody's like, I found an Azure Active Directory vulnerability. I was like, cool. Let's make sure it applies to us before we go down this big old rabbit hole of like writing detections for it, because it may not, you know, maybe you're not writing the service that applies to this particular thing. And that happens, you know, there's a lot of optional services in Azure. There's a lot of optional services in M365 that you may not be using or may not apply to you, or you may have a policy that negates them. Like you may have conditional access that makes this not a thing. So it's like knowing your own environment is super, super critical, because like people think the cloud is like really homogenous, right? Like it's a sort of a blank slate. And it's not. It's very much just like really heterogeneous. And it really depends on what your specific environment has in it as far as deciding when a threat report applies to you or not.
I think that's super important to hammer on, is that the cloud is not this perfect architecture that was built out by Microsoft or AWS or whoever. And everything fits together nicely and everything works together correctly. It is just like every other technology you've ever worked on. It's duct tape, it's tongue depressors, and it's just been cobbled together through whatever parts they found in the garage.
Yeah, you know, and it's like, you've got to do that when you've got existing products, right? Because like the person who designed this, you know, has probably been retired for 10 years. How does it work? this is our best guess.
Yep.
We got to pipe it and make it talk to all our other devices. And this is how we're going to do it. Don't look at it too closely. On to the next sprint.
So often when I worked on Microsoft products, and I don't want this to be like a total bash fest on Microsoft, it's just what I worked on an awful lot. So I got stories. A lot of the time, if I worked on a product that had been rebadged, they acquired a product and they'd renamed it something. When I was doing the installation and looking at the service names and the executables, it would still be the old product name. They changed the logo. They added like one integration, but it's still that thing of that company that they acquired. And now it's under the Microsoft moniker, but that doesn't mean it integrates really well or that it has anything in common with the way that the other applications you're using were written.
Right. You know, they may use a naming schema that's completely different. Like their API is going to look totally different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's all going to be different. So yeah, knowing what you have and what that product is doing specifically is important.
Intune was the bane of my existence for a while. oh, I see the face. And Intune was an acquisition, and it felt like an acquisition and continued to feel that way for an extremely long time. And they wanted to replace System Center Configuration Manager with Intune on endpoints. And I was like, no, please don't.
Yeah, mobile is hard. I remember working with that as like a system admin, and I don't think I've seen so many people upset with me like ever. Not even like when Exchange like moved the attachment button in Outlook. Worse than that. Oh, man.
Nothing will ever beat the introduction of the ribbon in 2007. I was a help desk person at that time, and I got a lot of angry calls. Just want my old menu back. Sorry, you can't have that.
Yeah. And they're like, why? I'm like, do you really want to explain to you what a WSUS server is? Why I can't go in and just update the golden image just for you? Or do you just want to say I can't do that?
I'm just going to say I can't do that unless you have a sufficiently high enough title, in which case, yes, I will be right there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We will make a second image just for you.
I'm curious. This sounds masochistic. This sounds so hard. So how do you make it not burn you out? Or does it? Is that the point of humor here, to keep you from burning out?
Yelling helps.
At people or just at the sky?
Yes.
Okay.
Preferably not at people, but like yelling at the sky helps. It's really cathartic for me to look at this, be like, does this make sense to anyone? No? Okay. Like that's what keeps me going. And like just knowing that it's hard and like breaking down the idea that we're supposed to have this all figured out and that it's supposed to be clean and nice and accessible. It's not. It's hard. It's complex. Mm-hmm. It's messy. We're going to mess up. I feel like I'm pretty good at words. I'm pretty good at reading and understanding. This is the hardest thing I've ever done, like in my career.
Wow.
So I guess if I take one thing away, that's what I want to show people is that, guys, this is ridiculous. It's okay to acknowledge that it's ridiculous. Now that we've acknowledged that it's ridiculous and we can stop beating ourselves up or feeling dumb about not understanding this product, we can actually do something productive. That's how I approach it.
It's sure different behind the scenes. Before I got into computers at all, I used Facebook starting like 2006 because that was the beginning of my college career. And it just worked. You know, and Google just works. And I just assume that like they configured it correctly and then they stepped away and no one touched it again. And it just continued working correctly forever. And now that I'm in engineering, I've found it's breaking all the time. All the components are breaking and stressing and moving. And there are so many people fighting fires all the time to keep any of the services you use working. It's just that poster on the wall that's still there and it's pretty and it looks like Facebook's still up and Google's still working. But there's so much people behind it keeping everything secure and up. And it's just wild how messy things are. And
yeah,
we're just not generally aware of that. We just assume that computers just kind of work and they don't.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Like there's a ton of work that goes on behind the scenes to keep everything running. And Microsoft, to their credit, has done a pretty good job making a product that works, that interfaces with a ton of things, that has a ton of interoperability, that has a ton of compatibility. Like hats off to them for like taking all of the stuff that they've built over the years, stitching it all together, making it work. For end users, the experience, I think, is pretty darn good. The problem is when you advance beyond being a user and become a security engineer. Because when you're a security engineer, you take on some of that responsibility for how the product works, which means you have to understand it. And that's when the difficulty level just skyrockets.
Right.
Being an engineer is super, super different than being a user because we have completely different needs. That's reflected, I think, in a lot of how Microsoft approaches teaching their product, because a lot of how they approach explaining things is geared toward either end users or administrators, because that's like 95% of who uses the product. When you become a security engineer and you have to start understanding the nuts and bolts, you have to start understanding like how things are constructed, that information's not there. You have to find that out yourself. And that's when it gets really hard. And something I think that, you know, people today don't really realize is so hard until they make some agonizing, expensive, messy mistakes and realize this isn't what I thought it was going to be.
I think as an engineer, which is what I attempt to be, I have not attempted to be a cybersecurity person because I don't want to have to know all that stuff. You know,
like, yeah.
I want to be this vertically integrated technical person who just sits in my little box and I make the computers work. But having to like be aware of all that context all the time sounds exhausting. Not only having to have that engineer skill set, how does it work specifically? But like, is it exposed? How critical is it to the business? What are your RPOs and your RTOs? All of that stuff you have to know. I can imagine that's just so easy to burn out on it and so much to learn.
It's a lot to learn, especially when you're dealing in really big orgs. Like my employer is like easily, I think official headcount is like 60,000 people, but like we've got way more contractors. We've got way more users in that environment. You've got to break it out into teams. You've got to have people dedicated to looking for the threats. You've got to have people dedicated to building the architecture. You have to have people dedicated to very specific parts, because no one person can do it by themselves. And you're right, it's a tremendous amount of work. Yeah, I don't really have a good answer other than, yeah, it's a lot. I think everybody's still like trying to figure out like the best way to like to structure teams, to like divide up the work. We tweak our processes, as a lot of people do, a lot, to be like, you know, how are we going to adjust to the updated threat load? How are we going to adjust to like needs for scoping new log sources, et cetera, et cetera.
How do you prioritize what you investigate and look at in the threat landscape?
So at my job, we have a cyber threat intelligence team, and they are looking at the big bads, usually APTs, because in my vertical, we are targeted by APTs.
Mm-hmm.
And we're figuring out, what are the APTs going after?
And those are advanced persistent threats, right?
Correct.
Okay.
So what are the big bads, big, smart, resourceful bads going after? We also look at like other threats too. Like it's not always APTs. Sometimes it's just like some script kiddie running a Metasploit module somewhere. We can do detections for that. But typically what we do is like go to the threat intelligence team, be like, what do we need to worry about? And then they will do some snooping and they will come back and be like, we need to worry about this. And say, okay, so how does this apply to us? And I go into our environment and I say, these guys got hit by this attack and it was running these servers and it had these ports open, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't really apply to us, but there is another component that may apply here and we should focus on that. And that's how I would approach it.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody approaches it a little bit differently. But typically, yeah, it follows the cycle. You have some sort of intelligence, whether it's through a threat hunt where you're like going through your environment. We're standing up a threat hunt team where we just have people that go in our environment and they look for bad. When they find some bad, if something that they think could be bad, they document it. And then that will feed into our pipeline. We have the threat intelligence team. Sometimes we'll get like CISA alerts, you know, CISA advisories being like one of those for like the mail items accessed log item. That was a big deal. I think it was over a year ago. That was the E5 licensing item that got added into the E3 logs after it was discovered that not including that particular item in the E3 logs cost the State Department a lot of money and exposure. And yeah, I think I might be butchering that characterization a little bit. That's what I took away from it.
The framing was basically that you could not possibly secure yourself unless you were paying for the highest tier of license, right? So like Microsoft basically blackmailing their customers was the framing that came out in the media, and it just looked very poor for Microsoft.
Yeah, you know, and they've done some massaging around that since, but you know, the fundamentals are still the same. So they added in that one item from the E5 licensing into the E3 licensing. I don't know if they've added in others. Like I know that they've added in that one. It's like, we'll do a detection all around that. Be like, okay, you know, what's our suspicious use of mail items access? Do we have any of that in our environment? Like, let's write a detection for that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it can come from a variety of sources. Sometimes we'll have an executive or we'll have somebody in the C-suite be like, we really need coverage on this. We're like, okay, you got it. And we'll do that.
If you have a junior engineer join the team,
mm-hmm.
How do you get them started? How do you get them ramped up considering like the fire hose that they're going to be drinking from?
It helps to have a solid background. Like everybody on my team has at least 10 years of experience, I think, except for me. I have 8.
Okay. When you say background, like what type of background would you recommend?
So I personally feel that you should really, really have hands-on experience configuring and working with enterprise computing systems, large enterprise computing systems. Like I came up from help desk. I initially tried not to do the help desk route, and I just found out that it was really hard to like get good jobs without it. So I went on to a help desk as a tier one help desk and moved my way up until I actually got recruited to be a cyber engineer. That experience was invaluable. Like working at a small shop where you get to touch everything, where you get to like just get dumped into situations where something's on fire and like you can call if you need to, but like you got to figure it out. Like that's extremely valuable. And like I lean on that every single day. So like having hands-on experience with the tech that you're going to be touching is so important, because otherwise it's just not real. You don't get that muscle memory. it's really hard, like when you're in the middle of like an incident, for example, as an incident responder, like if you don't have prior knowledge of that, to like really think through like how an attack would work unless you've spent a lot of time with it. And that's just the issue I think that some people breaking into cyber want to skip over, is that you've got to put the time in. You've got to make it so that the stuff is like muscle memory, so that you understand the underlying tech. Because when you're stressed and you're in a crunch and you're trying to like solve a really difficult problem, like all your book learning is going to go right out the door.
Mm-hmm. That resonates with me because I also started on help desk and worked help desk for the first, I think, 3 or 4 years I was in tech at two different companies. And what I learned from that was invaluable in being a good sysadmin leader, because I understand the end users and what their needs are. And so I've got that in the back of my brain. And I also understand like how clients are going to talk to servers, and how mobile devices are integrated into the environment. And I never went into security, but I think I got this solid foundation from working help desk and working my way up. And yeah, you can't do like a 90-day boot camp and get that level of knowledge. There's no way to do it.
No, you can't. And the other thing too is that it's really hard to get access to systems you're going to be doing cybersecurity on unless you've worked at a really big company, because it's like, who has like $90,000 to stand up, you know, a bladed server?
Yeah.
Like nobody does, you know? Mm-hmm. Who's going to put a failover switch for a failover ISP in their house? Like nobody. But like, you're going to see that in an environment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you can set up like software load balancers, but like, how do you configure a hardware load balancer? How do you deal with all this other very expensive stuff that you're not going to see until you get a job in it? That's what I think a large part of cyber hiring is running up against, is people like they want to get in there and they want to get the experience, but like companies don't want to throw you at some very expensive stuff and say, go secure it unless you actually know how it works.
Right.
It's a big old risk for them. So like knowing how the expensive stuff works is going to make you a much more strong candidate as a cyber engineer.
I love this framing of starting with help desk, because I agree that helped me so much to just understand people, because people don't have their computers on for a month and then it falls out of sync with their timing, and they have their phone and they upgrade to the new version before you tell them to. And like just understanding that these are people doing their best, and we have to make these computer systems both technically secure from the bad folks on the internet, but also work for the people that need to use them to do stuff. And doing both of those things is a really fine line to walk. It's a difficult place to find.
Yeah. And I think you hit it exactly, is that when you're doing help desk, you have to sort of like explain how some of the stuff works, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know something really well until you have to explain how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it depends a lot of the time on the end user as to like how much detail you need to go into. But that's a super valuable skill too, because it reinforces your own learning about the systems and why something's broken and why that person needs to take a particular action to make it work better.
Yeah. And it challenges your assumptions,
mm-hmm.
because you're working with somebody else's mental model that doesn't match yours.
Yeah.
And they have different assumptions. And when those two things don't line up, you have to be the one to break through it and go, oh, when I told you to turn the computer off and turn it back on, I didn't mean the monitor.
Yeah.
Ask me how I know. That was a pretty common one.
That's funny.
Well, it's 2024.
Mm-hmm.
So we are legally obligated to ask you about AI.
Okay.
How is AI affecting your role in threat detection engineering?
Right now, not a lot. Because AI is, from my perspective, fancy statistics, and AIs need to be trained and they need good data to be trained. And the problem with that is that it's real hard to find good data out of like cloud products, because for all the reasons that we touched on earlier, like 30 years of tech debt yeeted into the cloud, right? It's hard to get something uniform and consistent out of that. You have to like almost fundamentally change how that product is logged. And we don't have that power without jail time. Let's not go there. Let's not go to jail to fix logs. So I think, you know, AI for threat detection, there are some things that it does well. I know that there are products coming out that will do things like, you know, suspicious time access, for example, like if somebody's logging onto your DC in the middle of the night from, you know, North Korea, that's probably a bad sign. Mm. So some obvious things like that it does well, but there's also a ton of noise that these products are creating. And so there's very much a learning curve. And getting good people to understand both the technical side of like getting good data and keeping it clean, and making sense of that data, and also know the security side and like how security works and what threats you need to, like, it's extremely hard to find people that do both those things. So I predict that getting really good AI security stuff is going to be fairly slow because we don't have good logs for a lot of stuff. And it's just hard to find people that have enough of the skill sets to really make a thing that works.
As I've been interfacing with AIs, you get tricked sort of by ChatGPT that it's currently up to date with what's happening now because the AI has the ability to like go on the internet and check stuff. But generally, these models are at least a year old when they were like officially trained. And so I cannot imagine, unless we get these unit times, these cycle times way further down, that they will have up-to-date information about how quickly this industry changes and even how quickly like Azure AD became Entra ID. Those types of things happen way more frequently than every year. So I don't know how we get them there with this generation of AI. I just don't think it can happen.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. I think there's too much change, it's too complex, and the logs aren't good enough to really like expect AI to solve our security problems. I think it's going to make things faster. You know, it helps me with my research and like finding things to look at, but I still have to go in and like verify, do these tools still work? Like, when was the last time this repo was updated? Like, is this technique been patched? Is this log still structured the way it was when this thing came out? It shortens some of the work, but it doesn't eliminate it. You still have to very much do your due diligence. So in that regard, like, it can help. Is it a panacea? Absolutely not.
And the problem I find with a lot of AI is it's so confidently wrong.
Yeah.
That it can trick you.
Yeah.
And it'll get very simple facts wrong. And so I've learned to just check every time that it pronounces something so confidently. I go, is that really true? Does Microsoft even have a service named that? And sometimes they don't, you know?
Yeah, I'd be like, is that true? Like, I can't find this anywhere. Like, sorry, actually, it's this completely other different thing that I didn't mention previously. Here's the right way to do it with a package that's been out of date for 6 years.
Mm-hmm. Here's how to do this with PowerShell version 2. Great. Thanks for that.
Yep.
Well, one final question while we're wrapping this up. So it sounds like life has not really been improved yet at work with AI. What about with stand-up comedy? How is AI impacting that career?
Oh, that's a great question. You know what? I think AI has definitely been used a lot to generate content. I haven't seen it write really good jokes, unless they're just really absurd, in which case they might be funny, but accidentally. But like, I haven't seen AI being used for comedy yet, but that would be a thing to watch out for and also be a little sad about. Is AI taking our stand-up comedy jobs?
I asked ChatGPT to write a knock-knock joke for me.
Yeah.
And it does not understand the formula that makes a good knock-knock joke. It cannot do it.
What did it tell you? What was the joke?
It was in the right format. You're like, knock-knock, who's there? Gemini. Gemini who? There's two of us. Ha, ha, ha. And it's like... That actually might be a better example than what I got. It did not know how puns work. And so it didn't understand how to take a knock-knock joke and insert a pun that made the response funny. And so it was just a lot of, who's there? This thing. And then, ha-ha, I've fooled you. I'm this other thing. And I'm like, no, that is not... You don't get it.
That's not funny.
So I think, at least for now, I think humor is safe because it's far too complex for these large language models to grok.
Yes.
We're safe.
We still have jobs for now.
Yay.
For 2 years, maybe three.
Yes. Fingers crossed. Well, thanks so much for having me on, guys. This is super fun.
Absolutely. That's a wonderful place to wrap this up. Thank you so much for appearing on the podcast. If folks want to hear more from you and see all of your future podcast appearances, which I'm sure are coming, where can they find you on the big bad internet?
You can find me on LinkedIn, Lydia Grassley, and also lydia.grassley@gmail.com. So hit me up.
Word.
Thank you so much, Lydia, for appearing on Day 2 DevOps, and virtual high fives to you, dear listener, for tuning in. If you have suggestions for future shows, we'd love to hear them. Hit either of us up on LinkedIn or send some feedback via packetpushers.net/FU. The FU stands for follow-up. You can find me, Kyler Middleton, blogging over on letsdodevops.com and my stupendous co-host, Ned Bellavance, at nedinthecloud.com. And we're both active on LinkedIn. Stop by and say hi. And if you like engineering-oriented shows like this one, visit packetpushers.net/subscribe. All of our podcasts, newsletters, and websites are there, and it's all nerdy content designed for your professional career development. Until next time, just remember that doing DevOps is awesome, and so are you.